Welcome back to another episode of the Preble Hall Naval History Podcast. I'm Claude Barraby, Director of the U.S. Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis. Our guest for this episode is retired Admiral Al Kelm, Naval Academy class of 1952. He served on submarines and was the engineering officer of USS Enterprise from 1963 to 65 and commanded USS Ray and several submarine divisions, squadrons, and groups. He was director of the Strategic Submarine Division in the Office of Chief Naval Operations and retired as the Deputy Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency in 1980. His book is Living the Miracles, A Sailor's Life in the Nuclear Power Age. Admiral Kelm, thank you very much for joining us, sir.
Yes, my pleasure.
Sir, you hold a very unique distinction in the United States Navy. I think you were the first person to accomplish a very rare trifecta because you stood on, flew over, and sailed under the North Pole, and you were the first person to do so. I was wondering if you could just give us a few of your recollections of doing all three and how those came about.
Well, the first one was a flight over the North Pole, and 2 weeks before we made our first skate voyage to the Arctic, we suddenly decided that I should get a camera, obviously one big Navy camera that I had no idea how to operate. And but I learned fast, and go up and just peruse our intended track, and to make sure that there, since this was a really spectacular unknown, so many people had given up their lives to do what we were going to do, in the past, and so. The flight was worthwhile, and it was very comfortable to see the number of polynyas openings in the ice, and that it should be a reasonable trip. And so that was the first trip, and then the second, and I flew over the North Pole, and then the second trip was the visit to the North Pole. Was on our first summer Arctic cruise, and we unfortunately had a massive ice area over the North Pole, and we were only going to be in the Arctic for another week and a half, so and had other things to explore, and so we went under the North Pole, and then we circled it at about a half a mile radius. So I can say I went around the North Pole faster than most people. So, and then the third, of course, when President Eisenhower heard of our trip, he had his son come visit the ship and just to see if we were for real, because as an Army guy, they don't especially like ice, and they want to make sure that a trip is doable in the winter. And when his son debriefed us from our first trip, he came back to his dad and said, go 100%, let him go on the third trip. And we did that. And of course, that was an interesting trip also. But the important thing was that we went directly to the North Pole in the big winter ice. And in so doing, we had the remains of Sir Hubert Wilkins, a previous Arctic explorer, dead and for years. And his wife wanted his ashes buried at the North Pole. So we accomplished that also, and had a wonderful funeral for the ceremony for the funeral. So got submerged after that first that North Pole visit. The skipper called me down and said, you know, if you want to be, you can be an Arctic explorer just with those bona fides. And he said, do you want that? And I said, no, I want to learn how to be a skipper of a submarine and do all the wonderful things, because remember, that was within a year and a half of our commissioning, and or maybe 2 years, but it was really spectacular to think that a ship would go up and survive. And because all of the other history, the history books are full of people trying to go up and wooden ships, and most of them didn't make it back.
Now, when you completed that trifecta, was there any recognition by the Navy that this had actually happened, or was it already planned and known by the senior leadership that you would be this first person?
No, it was not a pre-planned idea at all. It really was not even discussed on the ship. I and the executive officer, and he jokingly said, well, Kellen, since we can't surface here, you've lost a chance to be a hero. And I said, I don't want to be a hero like that. And the captain laughed. And so it was not anything that was getting our attention. But after you do it and have this big ceremony and you look back at history, it was something that you could observe and talk about and document, and so many people had died trying just to get there. I felt very blessed. And I would, of course, it was only circumspect. It was never planned for Kellen. We just weren't that conceited.
Now, when you entered the nuclear Navy, you must have been interviewed by Admiral Rickover then.
Yes.
Do you have any recollections of that interview?
Yes, another kind of a spectacular interview that most people had. And I say that with authority, because when I went back there for my engineering certification some years later, I was the inside guy when Rickover was interviewing. But my interview was kind of walk in, say good afternoon, sat down. He asked me two questions. And of course, I asked them, it was all about Oklahoma, who was the governor and congressman. And so he said, Kellen, get out of here. You'll probably do okay, or something like that. Which was nice to hear as a candidate, because he normally didn't say anything like that. Later, Admiral Rickover did a lot of flying, and I was in various positions in the Pentagon during those times. And I'd get a phone call like at 2 p.m, and he says, Kellen, I'm taking off at 4 at the airport, and be there. Click. And so every time I had a new job in the Pentagon, I always warned my senior, I may get an invitation to go flying. And they said, Al, don't even worry about it. Just get out there and do it. And if you want to do anything, put in a good word for me or something like that. Those trips were very interesting and was never focused on any kind of serious discussions with me. He would look at me and kind of stare at me, but in retrospect, he was just sizing me up for, I guess, my next job, which happened on short notice. The shortest of which is a telephone call. I was due to go be the squadron commander at Holy Lock. I had orders, and the movers had come that day and so forth. And we were going to get underway for Holy Lock the next day to become the squadron commander. And the number two, Chief of Naval Operations, who also was a submariner, called me and said, your orders have just been changed. You are going to relieve submarine bureau of a detail, personnel detail. And he said, I know you're going to, you've been detached and you're going to leave town tomorrow. And he said, do you want to go? I'll face the admiral if you want to go and do that job. And I said, admiral, you know, and he's a wonderful submariner. I just wasn't a friend. I hadn't met him. And he said, you know as well as I do that you would lose just like I would lose that argument. It's far better for my career and for the Navy to let me relieve Admiral Watkins. Actually, he was a captain at the time. Captain Watkins, let me do a good job there and things will cool off. And he said, okay, Al, he was sorry that we had to unpack overnight, but we did. Everything worked out. I had a good tour as the detailer, and that detailer has a lot of responsibility in the sense that he also runs many of the Navy nuclear schools. It has a lot of responsibility, but I was happy to do it. And sure enough, the guy that went in my place made admiral, and a year later, almost to the day, Rick Over let me go to Holy Lot.
Now, you have clearly a very different perspective, or a unique perspective on dealing with the Soviets, really at the height of the Cold War, as commander of submarine squadrons and groups. Can you tell us, do you have any memories of dealing with the Soviets or what you had to consider in your role as a commander of those squadrons?
The squadron was really ashore and not the principal, but being detailed on several missions that involved the Soviet and Soviet Navy and the deployed Navy. It was a strong desire to do it. Normally, with the production of submarines, in the early days, every skipper, there was just a frequent new skipper doing that type of operations. So early on, I got a lot of experience as a lieutenant commander, really had analyzed the Soviet Navy's operational procedures and other little indicators of how they operate. And so when I got my command in the Ray, the submarine commander in Norfolk on my commissioning, he interrupted the commissioning ceremony when it was his term and said, I am going to do things out of order here. I just want you to know of my confidence in this guy. I'm going to fly, he's going to carry my flag for the rest of his tour. So here I was, the first guy that had never gone to operational at sea, being made the flagship. But little incidents like that happened, but he held his word. He gave, and you know, I learned so much. Let me just tell you one story of what I did and how much it advanced the submarine force. We were concerned about our own radiated noise and our ability to get certain frequencies of their noise, of the other country's noise, summary's noise. And so I had done some discussions with a classmate who was also assigned as a skipper, but his ship wasn't due to go to sea for a while, and gave me an idea about how we might better operate our ship sonar in certain frequencies. All of that said, I made those moves, and which involved the ship's noise analyzer from the engineering department. Now you can see where I'm going. And we really made a breakthrough. And so I was over there, and about the 80th day of my patrol, the admiral sent me his deputy sent me a message saying, come home. And I sent him one back when I had a chance to say, no, I've got more to do. And finally, I think it was around the 85th day or something, it was a personal from him in whatever code he was using. And he said, in using good language, he didn't use that, but he said, get home. And so we turned around and came home. But I did a lot of good operations for him. He put a lot of responsibility on me. And just that one little thing, every submarine in the submarine force, and there must have been at least 12 or so at that time, modified their commercial sonar to the modifications that I and my sonarman had made. And that's the way we progressed in those days, word of mouth. Go ahead.
You had another, I believe, unique experience as chief engineer of the USS Enterprise from 63 to 65. If I'm not mistaken, that was, were you chief engineer during Operation Sea Orbit?
Yes. That again was really an interesting assignment. I was the commissioning XO of the John C. Calhoun and under construction, and we were getting ready for our first fill in the shipyard. The skipper, Dean Axine, had reported aboard just before that time. After he had been there about a week, the Admiral Rickover called us about 7-1 Friday night, read me a story or an order that I am hereby detached as executive officer and Monday morning report as chief engineer of USS Enterprise. And so we got that message and Rogered, and I told Dean Axine, of course, I'm a lieutenant commander and Dean is a senior commander in those days. I said, you know, I have not in the prototype, I have not qualified on the aircraft carrier's reactor system. And I think you need to tell the admiral, he might have got some bum information. So finally, Dean called the admiral and said, Admiral, we think you made a mistake. That was the key word that he should have not used. But Kellen has not qualified on the A1W reactor system. And the admiral said, again, with plain English, if you want him qualified as an A1W operator, so be it. Make sure he's there Monday morning. And with a lot of words in there. And so we hung up the phone and I shook hands with Dean Axine and said, well, boss, it's your problem. I'm going to Enterprise. it was three new surface ships, the first three. As we left the Mediterranean after 6 months deployment, and they were part of the seventh fleet. As we were exiting the Straits of Gibraltar, we got a flash message for us to form up as an operating unit. And the three of us nuclear powered ships were to circle the world. And that would be the first time nuclear powered surface ship had ever circled. And to visit, I think 12 or 15 ports to do on air shows and other things for the friendly countries. And we did that. It was quite a cruise because we went at unbelievable cruising speed instead of, 15 knots like use normal fossil fuel units do. We were going at 25, this task unit. When we were in Australia, the children of Australia to the children of the United States gave us a kangaroo. And so suddenly the XO looks at me and says, "Where is your kangaroo cage?" And I said, "I don't have a kangaroo." He said, "Well, you've got 10 minutes to make one." So over a few hours, our damage control guys made a beautiful cage, accessible, the food trays and all of that. And we put Matilda in there. The next morning, Matilda was not feeling good. And my gosh, that's the crisis. This is for the children of the United States. And it turns out the doctor quickly analyzed that sailors had been going up there on the midshift and feeding Matilda. And the poor thing was just barely moving around in the cage. And so we posted the doctor there. And then my guys had to put on another layer of fence that they couldn't get food through the fence. So in the Navy like that, we have these serious problems that we use our talented people to solve.
Was there any opposition when you tried to get into certain ports or any concern?
No, we were greeted consistently. The countries felt so honored and so thankful both to the CNO and to Rickover to do the trip and to choose their country and to have these air shows. And these air shows from the carrier was unbelievable. I mean, they had more little rockets and stuff I didn't even know they carried. But anyway, it was a good show. The leaders of the various countries were so thankful and impressed by the fact that these three ships would not be resupplied with any food, any fuel, anything else on this trip at that speed. And they just felt like there had been this wonderful revelation or accommodation of technology to make ships that could do these spectacular trips. So they felt very positive about the United States and its visit. And it was good. And I would sit during the air show at the top of the group of visitors. And gosh, they were like young kids. They were so pleased that they were a friend of the United States.
Did you have any major technical challenges during that round the world cruise?
Not so much around the world technical, no. We in the Enterprise, I had everybody getting ready for the shipyard because when we came in to Norfolk and tied up, immediately we started cooling down some of the propulsion plants. And but we had enough power left to get over across the bay to Newport News. While we had been in the Sixth Fleet, I had gotten these, it was probably close to 1,000 work orders from the various departments. And of course, I, the chief engineer, had the authority to cancel or approve the job order coming from the ship. The normal feelings were it would be a couple of years overhaul. And as you may know, I had commissioned or been on two other ships constructed there, plus the one under construction. And the shipyard had somewhat of a respect for me as a chief engineer, because I attended every engineering meeting, and I had my comments and my estimates of how long it would take. And I in the shipyard sometimes clashed progress. And but the whole point trying to, that I was there and Rick over kept giving me a pep talk, was the that we could get that ship in and out, refueled, 8 reactors, a lot of modifications to the air system control, and in less than a year. And I told Admiral I could do it. And it took 11 months and about 20 days to get us through. And a lot of good stories there. The sub Air Lant had called me to his audience before as the overhaul started. And he gave me a ticket for $2 million. And he said for me not to tell anyone else on the ship that I have authority to spend $2 million above budget. And the skipper and the XO of the Enterprise would be told later, but was specifically because of the reactor and so forth, my responsibility. And so we did that, and we refueled those reactors and did so many changes and additions. And on the 11th month and about the 5th day, we were in dry dock to get ready for sea, that the overhaul had gone exceedingly well. And some of my balancing valves on the hull for ship control, damage control, and were leaking. And so shipyard came up and said, we will call back to work or not let them go home tonight, 250 or whatever the number was of engineers and guys that can work off of the letters and so forth, and replace every one of those valves. But it'll cost you $2.5 million. And of course, the shipyard always knows the, but I'm sure they knew about the $2 million that I had. And I said, no, but I'll give you two and don't say no. And they said, it's done. So we got the ship out. And of course, it really is a tough job to understand the construction of various systems for each other. For instance, the skipper of Enterprise wanted me to, and gave me a job order, to take a certain percentage of jet of oil, which they carried for refueling destroyers, normal conventional destroyers, and convert those to airplane fuel. And we did that, and gosh, that what a difference that made for Enterprise to be out there a month in the war zone and not be refueled. And so it was those type of things that the shipyard, once they heard that I had approved a certain job order, and their desire to accommodate me, we got a lot done extra. And of course, then the ship went off to the pack, and I was detailed to go to my new ship. So far, the trade school has gotten too busy to look at my book. So, but there's a lot of lessons in there, and one of them is be professional. If you're in charge of the engineering or a damage control system, the one guy that needs to know that system backwards and forwards, up and down, all of the, and if you do that, you can make wonderful decisions on the spur of the moment to save an operation and schedule or do the job better. And somehow I always had that desire to know everything I can know about the subject at hand. And that was, it was so obvious to me that I got a lot of phone calls from Rickover and a lot of questions. Never in his whole career did he ever give me a bad word, because he, for some reason, he just considered it done once he had given me the assignment. And that kind of trait has to be ingrained in the midshipman. And I'll finish here. I had no money at the Naval Academy, a very poor farm boy from Oklahoma. And so I studied 7 days a week, because I didn't have any money to go out and buy the grinder or anything. So I did a lot of studying, and that carried through the Nuclear Power School, and it's such a thrill to be able to design a reactor core or something else. There's a lot of unclassified things. I mean, classified things I really don't want to talk about, but you can really improve your ship and make it operate better the more you know about the details. And so that I think that's the reason Rickover put so much on my shoulders. When he went on an airplane to visit someplace, he'd always have somebody with him, and I was kind of the witness. So I was asked to be on the airplane, keep my mouth shut and listen. And he would be talking to whatever that scientist was that was, and so forth. The point being that Rickover needed somebody he could completely trust in. When Rickover came to Holy Lock, he in 10 minutes would say, "You're doing a good job." You know, that's about as gracious as you could get from him, but that's a 4-0 exam.
I really appreciate your time, sir.
Sure, no problem. Anytime. Happy to do it.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.